Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. If we can't create a more sustainable global order and find a way to restore economic dynamism, the decades after 2050 will be chaos. That's the warning put forward by our guest today, journalist and author Paul Mason, economics editor at Channel 4 in the UK. In his new book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future, Mason argues that what started in 2008 as an economic crisis morphed into a social crisis of global magnitude. The civil war in Ukraine, the triumph of ISIS in Syria and Iraq, the rise of fascist parties in Europe are all linked to a global economic crisis and the failure of the neoliberal economic model that emerged in the 1970s. In this era of stalled global growth, Mason is also deeply interested in how information is transforming our economy. Information promises to make goods more abundant and work unnecessary. That is scary if automation puts you out of a job, but it also undermines the very basis of capitalism. And Mason says it has the potential to take us to a more humane future of post-capitalism, the kind of future that most of us have a hard time even imagining, which is why I found this book so interesting and why I'm so glad to have this hour to talk with Paul Mason. Paul, welcome to Your Call.
Well, thank you, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to get to talk after reading your book, which is really, I say it's one of these kind of big picture books that also feels very, very immediate. There's so many things in there that I think most people who are living and working now can relate to and see their own lives through, but you also put it in this very long historical perspective. I want to start just by defining a couple of key terms, because I think they can easily go past and people think we know what we're talking about when we don't. First, capitalism. Just what is that? It's more than just a market economy, right? It's something more complicated than that. And we swim in it, so we often don't think about what it is.
Yeah.
And second,
yeah.
Neoliberalism.
Okay, look out the window. Look out the window in the places that where this program goes out. And what you see is a 200-year-old industrial economy. That's what we economic historians refer to as capitalism, because it's the moment when industry, commerce, markets, and finance all gelled together and created a system where GDP takes off, so growth per head takes off, productivity takes off, with the odd up and down period, the well-being of people generally rises, although we get child labor, we get horrible factory conditions in the early period. That's what I call capitalism. And in the book, what I say is that the essential point about that is whenever it's hit a crisis, this capitalist system has been able to morph or mutate and adopt new features that allow it to overcome crisis, so that all the traditional left-wing thinkers, Karl Marx, etc., were ultimately proved wrong by this ability to mutate and morph. The problem comes when information technology arrives, and my argument basically is that information technology, which surrounds your listeners there, is a new thing, and it prevents this adaptation. It prevents this defense mechanism from working.
Well, we're going to definitely get to talking about information technology, but before we do, I just want to, I mean, the most recent mutation, kind of adaptation of global capitalism, you argue has been neoliberalism. Right in recent decades. So
yes.
Talk a little bit about what that means and how you see that has kind of deferred what would otherwise have been crisis in capitalism.
Okay, a lot of people use the word neoliberal as an insult, because what it really means is a rip roaring, go getting free market capitalist who generally believes that that humanity prospers when everybody stabs each other in the back. But although that is the ultimate neoliberal philosophy, it's the philosophy that Margaret Thatcher followed, that Ronald Reagan followed, and the system they built was built with many of those principles in mind. What I mean by it is in fact the whole world system that has emerged during the last 25 years. So free market America, Wall Street dominated America, offshoring to China. So you know, the new Chinese factories are as much part of neoliberalism as the burnt out and abandoned ones in Pennsylvania. Okay, so neoliberalism is the way the world has been for 25 years, and it is highly dominated by finance, and it is highly its effect has been to suppress wage growth. Above all, there in America, you will know the famous statistic of static wage growth for the middle, you know, the median male manual worker, static wages since 1973. That's what that period has brought. And my argument is this neoliberal period, neoliberalism just means the reinterpretation of economic freedom in favor of rich people. I argue that that period is coming to a close because the essential thing that's been driving it, finance, debt, is over.
Well, before we get to the how it's coming to a close, I mean, you talk about the suppression of wages, and certainly, I mean, that kind of like the idea that a large swath of, in the United States and Europe, people have seen relatively static incomes. But at the same time, you point out that for, you mean, talking about all that offshoring, all that outsourcing, there's been big chunks of humanity over the last 20 years have seen real increases in wages. I mean, I think a lot of people would say, well, hey, maybe neoliberalism isn't great for the people who are already doing well in the world economy, but for a lot of other people, it was.
I think that is true, albeit that I slightly revolt against the idea that herding millions of people into factories so bad that they have to sign a pledge not to throw themselves out the window in order to get a job there. This is the famous Chinese Foxconn contract, which fortunately has been abandoned. I slightly worry about our, when Stalin said, you know, we must build great big, you know, kind of dams, canals, power stations, almost through forced labor, there was this kind of horrible argument, yeah, but it's worth it, yeah, but, you know, it's getting us out of poverty. And I do find it slightly distasteful, the idea that, albeit that the last 25 years have brought many people out of $1 a day poverty into $2 to $5 a day poverty, it's been done pretty brutally. But in any case, these countries, where we call them the emerging markets, India, Brazil, China, the Southeast Asian countries, they're all now facing crisis because they got the last bit of the stimulus. It was the last shot of adrenaline that was given by policymakers to neoliberalism went to the emerging markets, and now it's running out of effect.
And so I just want to, I mean, I value that revulsion you have towards that particular model, but just since that's one of the arguments made for neoliberalism and why, what the ends that it served. But so you're saying at this point, those emerging markets, they're heading towards their own crisis. So that's one side of thing, the kind of crisis that's going on when it comes to your book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. The other part of it is what you started talking about earlier, is this role that information technology is playing.
Yeah. So, depending on which computer they use, your listeners will know the fingers they use for copy and paste. Okay, copy and paste. On my computer, it's Command C, Command V. Once you can copy and paste something, the economics of producing stuff changes. Now, this is not my I didn't discover this, but American economists and indeed Silicon Valley people since the 1990s have been wondering about the impact on economics of a situation where you can reproduce something for free. There's minimal amount of work involved, you know, that my fingers move twice, and a small amount of electricity and a small amount of space on my hard drive. But copy-paste is a new kind of production. And it's not me, but the mainstream orthodox economists who argue that anything that can be reproduced for free, its price should eventually fall to free or close to free, close to zero. Now, you will have noticed that lots of information doesn't have a zero price attached to it. And that is because, I argue, the defense mechanism that the corporations have adopted in the face of this is to create artificial prices by creating the biggest monopolies this world has ever seen, dwarfing the monopolies that were created in the Theodore Roosevelt era that got everybody so angry. These monopolies are so big, it doesn't change anything to get angry. They can brush you aside.
These are Apple, Google, Amazon.
Apple, Google, Amazon. But, you know, if we list the full list, if I add BlackBerry to the list, you will know what I think the fate of these monopolies is going to be. and it's not just me, there are some powerful voices in business consultancy who think this as well, that you can't maintain monopolies when the only thing that stops your product being free is the power of your intellectual property lawyer. That's not capitalism. Capitalism is a system where the value in intrinsic in things depends on their use, their what they'll bring on the market, and the fact that they have some intrinsic ability to command the price. You, at your peril, you base a share price and indeed a whole system on the idea that your lawyers are going to be stronger than someone else's lawyers.
It may or may not be capitalism, but can it work and can it create wealth? And you know, if that's what these folks are trying to do.
Look, it's creating wealth. You bet it's creating wealth. You go onto those campuses in Silicon Valley and in Massachusetts where pure information companies are creating wealth for themselves, generating high share prices, generating returns. Yes, that can happen. The problem is that what they are doing, I argue, is suppressing competition and suppressing what economists call the price mechanism. So, you know, the things should exchange at roughly what it took to make them. That's what orthodox economics tells us. Strangely enough, Marxism also tells us the same thing, that what goes into a product more or less determines its price. But if what goes into a product is the simple act of copy-paste, then its price must fall to zero unless you suppress competition. And so you see corporations adopting all kinds of interesting tactics, which we study and we live with and we all use. I use all these services. But the interesting tactics they adopt are to kind of create big obstacles to competition. So, you know, or to anybody trying to sort of work around the fact that the information is easily accessible. And so, you know, the interesting thing when you study these companies is that they only compete with each other at the margins. There is almost in each sector a single big company. And, you know, your listeners will have bank accounts. I think this is true in America, but it's certainly true in parts of Europe, where the regulation says, you know, that the regulation is designed so that there are 6 or 7 or 10 providers of Main Street banking services. And if you walk into the branch of one of them, you can say, give me my money, give me my records, let me almost drag and drop myself to a different competitor. And you still have to trade with me. There can be no hard feelings. In the case of Facebook and Apple, we're talking about companies that you cannot withdraw what you have bought or indeed what you have invested in terms of your Facebook profile. To simply ask the question, why aren't there 10 competitors in the space that Facebook occupies, is to answer, is to provide the answer, because the whole system is designed in a way to create monopolies that prevent us having pricing power, that prevent us, the consumers, in other words, being able to dictate the price of something according to its quality, its supply, and its demand. In the United Kingdom, an Apple single track on iTunes has always been 99 pence. I think it's 99 cents in the United States. Yep. Forever. Supply, demand, quality of music never affects the price.
That's a signal there's not really a market operating.
Yeah. No, of course, what's happened to it? Apple has had to go to Apple Music because it's faced some big competitors who adopted a different model. And their model was to say, well, we share the music. And so the ones here in Europe, Spotify and Deezer, it's £9.99 or €9.99 per month. So you're renting and sharing the music. Now, somebody's done a calculation, and a website called Information is Beautiful did a calculation that showed that a solo artist signed to a record label would need 1,500 plays on iTunes to make the U.S. minimum wage, the U.S. monthly minimum wage, with that one song. And on Spotify, it's going to take 1.1 million plays. So there's once there's competition, what happens to the price of information is that it falls, and it falls pretty rapidly.
Paul Mason, I want to talk about why that matters and what you think the radical implications of that might be. Paul Mason is the author of Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. He's also the economics editor at Channel 4 in the United Kingdom. This new book, really, you're going to hear about kind of Paul Mason is not only talking about what the current crisis he sees in neoliberal capitalism is, but what might come next. I invite your calls, your ideas, your questions, your comments, how what Paul is saying resonates or doesn't resonate with what you experience. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. So Paul Mason, we were talking about, so you're talking about these kind of information monopolies that are information technology monopolies that are existing right now and how they're growing, how their power. Go ahead.
So look, where we got to is that information wants to be free. As the famous hippie theorist Stuart Brand, Sausalito resident Stuart Brand, was famously said in the 1970s, information wants to be free. Now, what's the problem there for capitalism? That information doesn't just inhabit our MP3 player. It doesn't just inhabit our computer and the internet. There is a growing information layer of the world. So that, you know, what is a silicon chip? A silicon chip is a billion switches printed onto a piece of silicon. Silicon itself is hard to make, and the good quality. The manufacture of that silicon chip demands good design and design of the molecular structure. Well, that design is a piece of information. And then the switches are printed or etched onto that silicon chip through a process that has been designed and therefore is a piece of information. And the design of the whole thing is a piece of information. So you can apply this to airplanes, you can apply it to automobiles. In fact, much of what we use is shaped by information and uses information. So here's the challenge. What we could quite rapidly do is create a economy in which we try to emphasize and accentuate this effect of information in order to make as much as possible cheap or free. And if you imagine quite a lot of the things around you being not expensive but cheap or free, then of course the problem is, why do people go on making them? But let's put that issue to aside for 1 second. You can begin to understand how we might go forward, not only out of this crisis that we are in, but out of what I argue is a quite broken and dysfunctional capitalism that we have created around us.
And what are the implications of that broken capitalism? I mean, obviously, in your book, you talk about what this is going to mean for workers and just the opportunity to have employment.
Yeah. The second impact of the information revolution is that it is broken the link, or is breaking the link between work and wages. A lot of people at the high end, a lot of people in creative industries or computing or engineering, get paid on the targets they hit and not the amount of work they do. And so it's quite normal. I sat on a plane this morning from Madrid, Spain to London, England, to be surrounded by people who are working for 5 minutes and then watching a movie for 5 minutes, and then they do some email for 5 minutes. Nobody asked them to start working. Nobody asked them when they stopped working. Maybe the lawyers on the plane are timing themselves. That's about all. Yeah. So we are becoming used to working to targets and working in a very non-managed way. Now, I think this is good. Everybody who works that way, kind of, you feel stress, but you kind of like it because it gives you control. It gives you control over micro portions of your day, which can be work or non-work, what we used to call life. So this is good, but as many of your listeners will know, there are some horrific projections about what the automation of middle-class work is going to do once it really kicks in. The Oxford University study that took place 2 years ago estimated that 47% of all United States jobs could be automated within 30 years, starting with retail and office management, and ending with mental health social work, in case you're wondering. So if we are facing this potential automation of a lot of work, then you know, there are two issues. For me, the first problem is it's all stalled. In actual fact, what this kind of capitalism does is to create a lot of low-wage, precarious, temporary jobs, some of which don't even need to exist. You know, they are not really necessary, but they're there to kind of employ people because we fear the levels of mass unemployment we'd had if we didn't do that. And there is a, you know, you can, a lot of people in those kind of jobs will know what I'm talking about. A kind of, well, if I wasn't here, would it really matter? I think what we should do is find ways to move on beyond this, this delinking of work and wages and use it in a way that promotes automation, but in a way that the automation doesn't damage society. And one of the buzzwords here, it's a bit of a buzzword right now in Silicon Valley, but it's a big buzzword in Scandinavia, that northern part of Europe where there's a lot of progressive thinking, is the idea of paying people from taxation just to exist, otherwise known as the universal wage. So if you paid people just to exist from taxation, a little bit, not a huge amount, you could almost subsidize and create a social cushion for the more rapid automation that I think needs to happen, because the more we automate, going back to my original point about copy and paste, the more information technology we can get into our economy, the more robotics, the more AI, the faster we can provide things with less work.
Paul, I want to bring in, we've got a lot of folks who are interested in talking to you, and I want to bring him into the conversation here on your call. We're talking to Paul Mason, author of Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. Let's go to Isaac in Berkeley. Isaac, welcome to your call.
Thank you for taking my call. Exciting discussion, very erudite. I can't wait to read your book. I'm interested in your perspective on the socialist view of capitalism, that its propensity to socialize itself is a reason why we should just adopt socialist principles. That's the way economies organically evolve, and the logic is that we should just be socialist. You seem to be arguing that we should artificially or somehow legislatively introduce a purely competitive model into capitalism. Am I hearing that correctly?
Paul?
Well, no, not, well, Isaac, thank you for that. Not quite. You see, I think that whole 20th century model of socialism, where people thought, well, because we've got big monopolies like sort of Standard Oil, and because states run a lot of things, you know, like the Department of Defense runs a lot of the economy, then all we need to do is take over that centralized, big hierarchical structure and run it in favor of people rather than in favor of profit. That's what I would think of as socialism. The reason people wanted to do that was because of scarcity, because if you want to run the society in the interest of the little guy, you have to redistribute stuff, and the state is best to do that. I think that there is almost like a route one beyond that opening up towards a much more egalitarian and small-scale and complex kind of solution to the problems capitalism throws up. So in other words, I see the route forward as being a lot of little players all competing in a way that allows the natural tendency of information technology to sink to quite a cheap or free status, information products. And then what do? Because I raised the question, but I didn't answer it. Why would people go on producing? They'd go on producing because if we could solve the issue of a basic income, this universal basic income, they would do other things. Work would gravitate towards those parts of the economy that still had profit and price and value in them. And a lot of people would then, I believe, begin to do things collaboratively for free, just as 27,000 people in the world regularly edit Wikipedia, just as thousands of software engineers collaborate for free to maintain and upgrade Linux, the operating system. I think we would begin to do that on real stuff, on actual concrete stuff you can put your hands on.
Paul Mason, we're going to be talking more about where you see the potential for this economy that right now is in crisis. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. Our guest is Paul Mason, economics editor at Channel 4 in the UK and author of the new book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. We'll be back right after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or a question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. Coming up in a half an hour, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. They'll be talking about inappropriate jokes told at the Oscars. And Nigerians are filling the streets in protest of bank charges. That and more on World Have Your Say from the BBC, half an hour from now at 11 o'clock.
Hi, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can find past shows and share programs that you were interested in, wanted to show to your friends, or send out on social media from there. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the root causes of Puerto Rico's debt crisis. And on Thursday, we're going to be looking at enslavement and exploitation in the global fish industry and some recent legislation that has been passed to counter it. If you have a show idea for us, you can always drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And you can join the conversation today with Paul Mason, author of Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. This is just out, really fascinating, big picture book about our economy and where it's headed. The number to call if you'd like to join the conversation now, 866-798-TALK. And Paul, if it's all right with you, I want to go straight to some more of our callers who wanted to join the conversation.
Yeah.
Garrett in Oakland. Welcome, Garrett.
Yes, I was just thinking that, and maybe you covered this already, I didn't hear the whole program, but the real problem is monopoly power that ruins the capitalist system. And the worst monopoly, I think, is patents and copyrights, which are way too long now. It seems to me with the global high-tech economy, we only need about 5 years of copyright instead of 30.
Mm-hmm. Garrett, let's hear from Paul Mason about this.
Well, this is one of the, you see, my book's called Post-Capitalism, and the idea sounds very radical, but what I'm saying is that there are elements of a new system emerging from within the old system, and this demand for shorter copyright is, in fact, one of them. Because, and I think you are totally right, because in economic theory, the assumption is that copyrights don't really stand the test of time. They get eroded. You know, the first ever factory was set up in England, in Derbyshire, and a carbon copy of it was created, I think, in New England 3 years later, despite the fact that the entire factory had been patented by the first ever factory owner, because one guy got on a ship and said, hey, let's build a replica somewhere else. This is the natural part of competition. That's what competition does. Now, I think if we shortened patents and intellectual property and copyright very dramatically, then we would contribute to exactly what you're saying. I mean, I happen to think that that even if we did that, we wouldn't save capitalism. But what we would do is we'd unleash this tendency of information to fall in price, so that, you know, there's a company here in Britain which is a kind of craft beer company. I know you've got some great craft beer companies there in California. We have one here. It just put its entire recipe collection for free, shareable online. And I don't mean just like three lines with which kind of hops. The detailed stuff that the actual brewers use has been published. And they said, look, you know, almost like if you're a big corporation, once you see this, they joked, your computer's going to blow up because you won't understand it. Because they said, you know, we don't want to copyright our secrets. We want to make profit and add value to the economy through the other stuff we do. So, yeah, I think that much shorter copyrights, not just for things like medicine, but for everything. I'm a book writer. I'm a filmmaker. I think that I only want, you know, I mean, look, my publishers wouldn't say this, but me as a person, all authors, you know, dread that moment when you see the book turn up in the charity shop or in the in the car, what do you call it, a car boot sale, we call it here. It's usually after 4 or 5 years that that happens. So, you know, okay, let's shorten copyrights.
Let's go next to Sam in San Francisco. Sam, welcome to your call.
Yes, hi, thank you. It's a fascinating program. I look forward to listening to the rebroadcast so I can try to, it's very complicated. And I wonder if I might ask the author to name some examples of, you referred a few minutes ago to kinds of work that are just to give people work, that they could be replaced. There's no reason for me to be here, you said. I'm just wondering what kinds of jobs, if you can name a few of such jobs, I'm curious.
Look, thanks, Sam.
Yeah, look, okay. I mean, there's a famous anthropologist here in Europe who describes these jobs. I'll use the shortened form as BS jobs, okay? The people who do them, we should have incredible respect for because they're working at the very precarious end of the jobs market. But I'll give you one example. Here in Britain, and I think it's the same across Europe, I think it may be even the same there in the United States, in parts of the USA. When I was a kid, my car got dirty. I took it to a car wash. The car wash was a machine. You put money into the machine, and maybe sometimes it took your aerial off or it scratched your paint. But overall, it did the job. A car wash was a machine. Here in Britain, if I say the word car wash, it calls to mind five very poor guys with rags. How can the five guys undercut the machine? Because we have these guys are probably working often in a situation where the official minimum wage is being flouted and undercut. So, you know, it's not productivity. If you look at as a macroeconomist, which is what I spend most of my time doing, one of the big problems central bankers, policymakers, governments have is the low productivity growth in the world. And the reason is that for every amazing automobile plant that's semi-robotized, every amazing plant where, you know, where they make solar panels. I went to a German solar panel factory where human beings never touch the materials. They just sit and watch it. For every one of those factories, you've got millions and millions of people, thousands and thousands of people, rather, doing jobs that are created because labor is so cheap. There's no incentive on entrepreneurs to invent new machines, new processes, new software to automate and make intelligent these production processes. And so that's what we've ended up with. And yeah, America and Britain right now are creating jobs hand over fist. But I know that the policymakers, certainly here in the United Kingdom where I'm sitting, are very unsatisfied with the kind of jobs that are being created.
And then I think that, I guess I'm just thinking right now we're a bit obsessed with our presidential race here in the United States.
Yeah.
And I think that sense of precariousness, of the sense that jobs as we understood them are either going to get crummier or go away, is feeding a lot of the appeal on left and right of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, obviously completely different prescriptions for the problem. But I'm just curious, looking from the UK, taking the big picture view you do, how you see that.
Well, yeah, I see that. And I think there's a bigger thing. It's not just the jobs. It's sociologists found something really interesting in the 1960s. That is, young male manual workers in the 1960s suddenly got very turned off factory work because they realized it wasn't going to last. They could see machines coming in that they knew could do the work eventually. And I think this was a source of the great labor unrest that happened here, that happened there. Something clicks in people's minds maybe 10 years before it really happens. Now, I think something's clicked in the minds of a lot of Americans, a lot of middle-class and working-class Americans. That is, the jobs, as you say, are going to be crummy, and even for middle-class people, this is going to happen. And meanwhile, the level of indebtedness of the federal government and the sheer amount of poverty and inequality we have makes it likely that this generation will be worse off than the next.
Why doesn't the resistance of that time, you know, that responded to some similar kind of, why isn't that being seen now, or do you see it being happening now?
I think labor doesn't have any power. Organized labor has no power. This is the way the economy is designed. This is why wages don't rise. I think I'm a trade union guy. Good luck to any other trade union people listening to it. But ultimately, the power is gone from the workplace because, you know, there is a limit to the amount of stuff you can do inside the workplace to change your conditions. So people have started to focus precisely on government. And you've got real serious critics of the financial logic, whether it's Trump against Wall Street or whether it's Sanders against Wall Street. You've got serious critics now of the whole system getting really serious votes. As you know, in Europe, we have a Greek government, 35% of the vote, which is technically a Marxist party. We have the most left-wing leader of the Labour Party, albeit in opposition, we've ever seen here in Britain. We've got 20% for a far-left party in Spain. It's happening. This is happening because people are, it's not just anger. People are really clever these days. They have access to levels of information my dad and grandfather never had. And so they can work things out for themselves. And they don't have to take what the media gives them. And that's what's fueling the discontent, the anger. And I think that, you know, today will be incredibly interesting for all of us across the world. Trump is on a roll. I don't think the Republican establishment knows what to do about him because they created all the anger. They fueled all the kind of sentiments that he's feeding off. I think that even if Sanders doesn't get the nomination, he will have pulled the Clinton campaign so far to the left on both economics and on the rights of women and black people and gays that you'll see a quite left candidacy from Hillary, certainly until she gets into the White House. Who knows what happens then? But I think, in other words, this anger and this groundswell that's happening, that's affecting even the centrist politician, it sources the fact that the neoliberalism, which we've been discussing all the way through, doesn't work. It doesn't work. We need an alternative to it.
Paul Mason is the award-winning economics editor of Channel 4 News in the UK, and his latest book is Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. We want to have you join the conversation. We want to know how the economy Paul Mason is describing and the potential alternatives he's describing as well resonate with you. Can you imagine a world after capitalism? And are there any places where you see those alternatives emerging now? We're going to hear more from Paul Mason about that, but we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or if it's easier to send an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to TJ in Santa Clara. TJ, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking the call. And this is an interesting discussion indeed. I remember back in high school, one of the books I had to read in a utopia class was a book called Looking Backward, which I think was written at the end of the 19th century and sort of raises the same idea. What could a society look like once the means of production are so productive without human labor that people really don't need to work? And we're not really articulating that right now and working towards it. We sort of lost our purpose as a nation or as a global society in thinking in those terms. Instead, we're thinking in terms of some people need to be on top and everyone else needs to be in service to that. And we have this idea of work, work, work. I'm sorry, I'm rambling on there.
No, that makes sense.
If you're familiar with that book as well as some of the movements that sprang up around it. And I think also in the Great Depression, we had some hearings about how to address the situation through consumption rather than through capital investment, and that's where Keynesian came from. But I'll take my answer now.
Thanks, teacher.
Yeah. So, look, the book you're referring to is part of the populist movement in late 19th century America, and there's a strong strain, indeed, of utopian socialism in America. There are still ruins of collective settlements called phalanxes in the Midwest, where socialist communities tried to make some of this stuff work. The problem is you couldn't make it work when there was scarcity. As long as you've got scarcity, as long as stuff is scarce, people have to work, and the mechanisms of the market distribute the fruits of that work unequally. So what we call utopian socialism was a disaster everywhere it was tried. What I think the fascinating thing is now that with information technology, aspects of this utopian, almost sci-fi socialism are real. They are possible. And I think that if we do what I was, you know, I want to start a debate, because I don't have all the answers. I have the questions, and I have the kind of, I have the whiteboard and a few of the post-it notes to put on that whiteboard. And it is about, okay, if we gave everybody the basic income, if we rapidly automated the economy, if we suppressed the power of finance, and here I'm with those who want to suppress the power of finance, could we, without resorting to kind of socialist planning or rationing or any of those big hierarchical things, could we create the conditions in which small-scale experiments in egalitarian, fair, well, in sort of wealthy in terms of food and sustenance and energy, communities could emerge. And instead of worrying always about dystopias, instead of every kind of dream we have being a nightmare, why don't we just stick to the dream bit and try and actually achieve it? That's really what my book is arguing. And instead of being a kind of far-flung 50-year to 100-year futurology book, what I'm trying to say is that we can actually start doing bits of it right now. In the crisis-hit communities of the world, and I'm sure this is the case in the United States, there are people volunteering to look after each other's kids. There are people lending each other money without interest beyond the family. There are people setting up time banks for volunteers. There are people setting up food banks for people who can't feed themselves. There are cooperatives. There are small-scale banks that are owned by their own savers. We call them credit unions here in the United Kingdom. This is a small sector, and if you add to that Wikipedia, Apache, Linux, Ruby on Rails, all the free software and open-source software, then it adds up. It adds up to a new kind of economy that all I want to say is I want policymakers to take it seriously and ask the question, could we nurture it? Could we do stuff that helped it rather than allow it to be squashed all the time by the giant monopolies who don't like it?
Well, I guess my question would be, so I hear you talking about people cooperating with one another and sharing things that seem to me largely around services. I hear you have the metaphor of copy and paste that's about information. But I think people need to eat, and they still need a lot of natural resources to keep any kind of society going. I mean, how does that – you know, I think most of us kind of go, well, okay, I understand that, you know, iTunes infinitely reproducible, but not the same for, you know, a cob of corn.
You're right, and it's also true of energy, although if we used renewable energy, then the energy – could be counted towards the general cheapening of the world. Also, if we used 100% recyclable, if we made stuff 100% recyclable, the concept is called cradle to cradle, as opposed to cradle to grave. Then again, we'd use less raw materials. That you can attack this problem from all angles. But the interesting thing is, of course, in other words, I think one of the last things to go would have to be agribusiness. You've got to have big food to feed big populations. But when you map this economy, when you map in Germany, where they're really keen on some of these ideas, they've begun to, an app is being produced that you can have on your phone that you can ask it, where is the nearest bit of the collaborative economy? And when they mapped the collaborative economy in Berlin this year, what they found is a lot of little collaboratively run vegetable gardens, market gardens. Of course, they're not wheat fields, they're not rice paddies, they're not going to feed the masses, but even food can be done this way. So I'm hopeful that through small scale, all I want right now is for the state and for policymakers to look at this sector and say, let's protect it. Let's encourage it. You know, it is services. Services, of course, are the economy. 75% of the economy is services. And that's what's exciting. We're not tied to making stuff anymore. A lot of the value in a modern economy that I think will survive, I think a market sector will survive, a profit-making sector will survive a long time in the project I'm proposing. But a lot of that will be in services, and services are easy to turn into non-profit, collaborative, still functional, still innovative, still entrepreneurial organizations. Why do we know this? Because the world's full of them.
Paul Mason, I want to bring in another caller, Craig in St. Leandro, who wants to take us into another part of the economy. Craig, welcome to the show.
Okay. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Interesting discussion. I'm interested in applying those sort of principles to housing. You know, we have a situation in the Bay Area which is really brutal, but, you know, you can manufacture housing at relatively inexpensive prices, and it would seem like if we're going to continue to lower wages and eliminate jobs, that we could also apply this to how we build housing and maybe dramatically reduce the cost of what people are paying for rents.
Paul?
Well, you see, I don't think that the dramatic, horrible, you know, situation that you describe has much to do with the production cost of a home. Although I think you're right that by automating the production of homes, you could automate the production of beautiful ones instead of ugly ones. You could solve the building problem. But the real problem is not building. The problem all over the world is that we have a finance system that treats homes like financial assets. And it has drawn large amounts of people into a situation where that if those homes did not carry on rising in value, so they could borrow against them, they too would be bust. So I think we have to switch off the logic of high finance and speculation. And one of the things we can do is rent control. You know, this is not anti-capitalist to suggest rent control. Half of New York City, on the last time I visited it, would still had rent control, even though you got landlords trying to chip away at that and throw people out of apartments. Rent control is important because it places a lid on how high speculators can drive the value of these properties. The other thing is social home building. Now, again, some of your listeners may not realize this, but you know, many governments here in Europe do this aggressively. You build homes to make supply match demand. The federal government or the regional government, the state, does it. My grandma, after World War II, got given a house by the local city government for free. The rent was almost zero, and that was seen as normal. Why, after 70 years of progress, do we have a housing shortage, people living on the streets?
Paul Mason,
I think we should be angry at it.
I think you got a lot of listeners who would agree with you. And we actually have an email, and just be, I know you've got to run. We've got a final email that came in from a listener named Howard who says, Mason's analysis is spot on. However, I don't believe that the entrenched white male power structure will give up power easily. The repression's already beginning through the dark money of the Koch networks, and I believe things will have to get bloody. And he asks, have you read Jack London's The Iron Heel? But I think, you know, in addition to his specific question, I mean, this is the big question, is where people might find the power to take to, I mean, you're talking about a lot of government action, a lot of policy. How do you know, when the entrenched money is really calling for a complete absence of the government from the market, how do you do that?
I think that the story of what's happened around climate change, yeah, big coal, big coke, etc., is resisting, but the share price values of the coal industry are plummeting. But what's happened around climate change is in the space of 15 years, you had a position where, you know, it was not even accepted that man-made climate change existed by corporations. So now the Paris conference, whatever you think about the outcome of it, inadequate though it might have been in last December, more or less puts us on a route where large parts of the elite, of the rich, have understood that if they don't stop doing stuff, it's going to destroy the planet. And here we've got the central bank boss, Mark Carney, the Canadian guy who runs our central bank, openly warning the carbon industries, the gas industry, the coal industry, that their shares might be worthless. So, you know, this is progress in one area. Where I would call for progress is not only on things like housing, not only on things like the cooperative movement being given space to operate, but above all, I think we have to tackle the power of finance. The power of finance is what misallocates the capital of the world towards, you know, we have streets and streets and streets in Europe full of coffee shops replacing small mom-and-pop retail businesses that took decades to build simply because somebody raised the rent. That's what we have. That's how capital allocates money right now, towards more and more coffee shops where more and more graduates can work in those coffee shops who should be building the spaceships, who should be building the cure for cancer. That's the problem. So I think until we address capital, we're going nowhere.
Paul Mason, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really appreciate your time and your insights.
It is a pleasure.
That Paul Mason is the economics editor at Channel 4 in the UK, Channel 4 News. His books include Meltdown, The End of the Age of Greed, and Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions. And his brand new book, just out in the United States, is Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. I've read it. Really fascinating. A lot to learn. And of course, a book like this, you only scratch the surface in a conversation of an hour. Thank you to everyone who called or emailed during this hour. You can learn more about Paul Mason's work, see some of his current writings at yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll dig to the roots of Puerto Rico's fiscal crisis. The U.S. territory is $73 billion in debt. It's used credit to pay for basic services with investor-friendly, tax-free bonds. But last June, the island's governor declared its debt unpayable. What roles have Washington and Wall Street played in Puerto Rico's crisis, and what are its far-reaching implications? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with guest host Renee Kemp and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.